Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dagena Dor, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we're talking to Dr. Courtney Brunt and Dr. Brooke Shitnick about their new edited volume, Buddhist Tourism in Asia, published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2020. Dr. Brunt and Dr. Shitnick, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And I wonder if we can begin the interview with some self-introductions and maybe please tell us a little bit about yourselves and how you became interested in Asia and contemporary Buddhism, specifically the topic of tourism.
So that's always a tough question for me. I don't know if I have like one real like moment or thing that made me want to go into this topic, but I was always interested in different cultures when I went into college, like different ways that people found meaning in their lives and in the world. So that led me to religious studies and as a major. And then I never really looked back from that. And I just kept studying it. And I took a kind of winding path to Southeast Asia through Japan, where I was teaching English and thinking about studying there a bit before I went to grad school and decided on Thailand and took my first initial research trips there and could really see a lot of interesting research topics just with the different kinds of material culture there and practices and everything that was going on there. I could see a lot of interesting themes for me that I would be really interested in. So I wrote my first book and dissertation and research project on international meditation centers in Thailand. And then from there, I just kind of could see Buddhist tourism more broadly as I lived in Chiang Mai for about 8 years. I moved to Thailand, actually, after I got a Fulbright in my third year of my PhD program. And then I never really moved back to the U.S. until I got my current position at Rhodes College in 2017. So living there, I was really able to, and teaching there, and teaching a study abroad program there, I was really able to see, like on the ground, the effects of tourism. And I was able to really understand contemporary Buddhism and kind of align my skills and interests with that while being there. And I miss it now and I hope to go back soon. But I'm interested to hear Courtney's story.
You know, I had a family member who was Buddhist and that very much was impressionable to me. And then when I was in college, I happened to study abroad in Asia. And when I stepped foot in China, I had this weird overstimulating sensation that I was home. And so China really began to feel like a place of residence. And so changed my major in college and started studying Chinese and continued to study religion and then moved to China after college to teach. And it's really been beckoning me ever since. And similar to Brooke, you know, when you are living abroad, you really begin to see these various components of a culture because you're a tourist too. You're a resident and you're a tourist, but you're not someone who is from the area. And so it really became interesting to me to see the changes that were happening in China, especially before the Olympics and then after the Olympics with Buddhist temples. And so now in my current position at Doan University, where I'm an assistant professor of Asian religions, I've been taking students on study abroad and still really thinking about these questions of what does it mean for Buddhists to engage in tourism and just the ongoing innovations and translations of Buddhists today to remain relevant to young folks with all these changing circumstances.
Thank you for sharing that, both of you, and I hope it will be safer for all of us to go back to our fields once again. So before we jump into the book, please tell us a little bit about how this book project began. So what inspired you to invite all these scholars to participate in this edit volume on tourism and Buddhism?
Well, I'll start and then we'll see what Courtney can fill in maybe about the participants part. But I think like we both said, we're both interested in tourism. We're kind of seeing that in our field sites and noticing that there was maybe some conversation around it, but really not much scholarship going on there. And we had both been to an IBES conference, it was the International Association of Buddhist Studies conference, and it was in Vienna in 2014. So that's when this germinated 6 years ago. So I remember that there was a presenter that didn't show up, and we were both at this like contemporary Buddhism session, and we had both kind of known each other's names from a graduate conference on Buddhist tourism, I think, that Courtney had been organizing. And so we left that panel and we kind of found each other and started talking and comparing our research. And then when I returned home, I sent her an article that I wrote about international meditation centers and tourism in Thailand. And I said, you know, I have the idea, maybe we should try and work on something to do with this, like an edited volume. And she wrote back saying she had the same idea. So it was really great that we could work on that together. And we had a workshop through the University of Oregon where Courtney had her first job. And we gathered people together there, and maybe Courtney will talk about that, how we found the participants, but I just would say that it's been great to work with Courtney, and if other people listening are thinking about co-editing a book with others, I think like you should consider the other people or person that you want to work with. I mean, I just happened to luck out because I didn't know Courtney beforehand, but it was very nice to work with her because we always made sure that everything was equal, like from our writing of our introduction to the very end when we were doing our splitting up our index, we were making that. And I think that that really came from the fact that we were both in almost exactly the same place in our careers. And that was extremely helpful in allowing us to understand each other and relate to each other. And then we became good friends in the process.
You just had to bring up the index. What a painful process. Yeah, it's been such a lovely experience. And this is the ideal, I think, when you're doing scholarship like this and you are able to engage in a partnership and to complement each other's skills. And yeah, we were very fortunate. I had a visiting position at Oregon State and they give us some funding to hold the conference. And having a book off of a workshop, I think Brooke would agree, really helped because we created those interpersonal relationships with our authors as well. And so having that shared experience, they had kind of gone on a pilgrimage, right? In that sense of coming to Corvallis. And so that really, I think, helped create these relationships, which helps with the writing process. So Oregon State fortunately gave us some funding to help with the conference. And then we also received funding from the Association for Asian Studies. So we need to recognize them as well. And we both Brooke and I kind of made a list of our ideal writers, and we invited those folks to come to Corvallis. And then for the edited volume as well, we also put out a call for additional potential authors as well.
Yeah, it was great. I'll just add that, you know, to work with, we like complemented each other really well, because I knew some people in Southeast Asia, a little bit in South Asia, and then Courtney knew all the people in East Asia. And these people, you know, now are part of my network, and I never really knew them before, but then I wouldn't have had access to this kind of scholarship of Mahayana Buddhism otherwise.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, this is a really welcomed addition to the growing scholarship on Buddhist tourism, specifically in contemporary Asia, right? So first of all, I was wondering how this idea of Buddhist tourism means in the context of this edit volume. Can you maybe clarify this for us? I was wondering, for example, how is it different from traditional forms of Buddhist pilgrimage?
So what we've seen a lot with scholarship, and what Brooke and I were noting in our own work, is that authors tended to separate tourism from pilgrimage. And that really wasn't what our site visits were showing us. Our site visits were really showing us that these kind of binary categories of sacred and secular, of pilgrim and tourist, it just didn't capture what was happening on the ground. And so when we are thinking about Buddhist tourism, we're thinking about activities and actions and reverence that are happening at sites associated with Buddhism. And so you see ardent pilgrims who will spend the day performing rites of veneration, and then they'll go and do KTV at night, right, as part of their activities. And so just as people are very multivalent and people are fluid, so too are these sites. And so our idea really was aimed at capturing the fluidity of spaces, capturing the fluidity of activities occurring in these sites of Buddhist tourism, and doing so by looking at case studies so that we could really do an ethnographic volume that focused on the activities of practitioners.
Thank you. That really clarifies it. Thank you. And the edit volume is divided into three parts, right? So the first part, entitled Buddhist Imaginaries and Placemaking, features four really interesting chapters on how Buddhism is marketed and promoted to domestic and international tourists, as well as how these imaginaries sort of sediment over time. And the first two chapters are, I found them really interesting when you read them kind of in a juxtaposed way. So David Gary's chapter on Bodh Gaya shows us how powerful the Buddhist imaginary is in promoting sacred spaces to the tourist gaze. And then John Mixick's chapter reveals the impact of disconnecting the Buddhist imaginary on tourist sites like the Tiger Balm Gardens in Singapore. So in these two cases, how does Buddhism imagined by the tourist and non-tourist alike, and what are the consequences of these imaginaries?
Thank you, Diana, for your question on imaginaries. And this is one of our main theoretical ideas that I think kind of runs through all of the chapters, but we put some of them, you know, fit more into it than others. And imaginaries is a kind of a loose term, but I think it's so important and necessary because I think we all can understand that we have an imaginary of a place, you know, before we travel there, and how that kind of interacts with our understanding when on the ground when we get there. And so we're not thinking about imaginary as, you know, like one, you know, one kind of Buddhist imaginary, and we're, you know, kind of aware of the diversity and multifaceted nature of this term as we look in these different places throughout the different chapters. So there's, of course, no one imaginary of Buddhism and no like one kind of tourist imaginary. And that's part of the work of this volume, to show the different variations and interpretations on Buddhist imaginaries from these different kinds of actors. And so I'll try to represent the arguments of the authors of these chapters, but I'll try and do as best I can. I wish they were all here to talk about it, but I guess that'll be really difficult for scheduling reasons. So I'm just going to try my best that David Geary's chapter on the imaginary of peace is really interesting to juxtapose with the following chapter, like Diana said, because he is talking about like the imaginary piece is so kind of like vague and diffuse in a way. But I think that, you know, that's a kind of a resonant imaginary with many people, especially those who don't know much about Buddhism. You know, the Buddha sitting in his meditation pose and kind of meditation and peace is the kind of one of the dominant images that in Bodh Gaya in India, that kind of tourist relations and state campaigns have taken advantage of, that David Geary notes, like the kind of branding of blissful Bihar, where Bodh Gaya is located. And it's a kind of zone of peace. But he notes how this imaginary of peace really obscures the reality of what's going on in the state of Bihar politically and economically. So you have this like idea of this is the space of the Buddha's enlightenment, where there is this kind of resonance of his achievement and, you know, the peacefulness that brings. But then there's this extreme poverty in the region and economic underdevelopment. And so Geary really explores this contrast really deeply between these Buddhist imaginaries and ideals, and then the on the ground political and economic causes and conditions in the area. And so then John Mixick's chapter on the Tiger Balm Gardens in Singapore is interesting to think about those in connection, because the argument is almost the opposite, because we can see the ways that imaginaries resonate differently here. So John Mixick, he's talking about how the Tiger Balm Gardens, like in the 1930s, they had a really strong connection to the imaginary Buddhism, and particularly narratives of like Buddhist cosmology of particularly hell, depictions of hell and other kinds of Chinese folk religious iconography. And then he traces how this was kind of lost over the decades as a private company came in 2015 and really kind of disconnected the site from any of these Buddhist imaginaries. And this was not successful in terms of revenue or tourist numbers. And so Mixick believes that if that connection to Buddhist cosmology, if we have that kind of specific imaginary of the hell realms, and with that comes the motivation to follow Buddhist morality, then that he thinks that the Tiger Balm Gardens could be more successful with the use of that imaginary. And since it has lost that imaginary, there's nothing really like specific tying it to anything within, you know, interesting within the tourist gaze anymore. So from these both chapters, we have like comparing the diffuse imaginary of peace in Bodh Gaya with the more specific imaginary of the Buddhist cosmology that was previously on display in the Tiger Balm Gardens. So we have like the specific imaginary that is crucial in making a place distinctive, and then in the other, the kind of more vague imaginary of peace that obscures a lot of the realities that are going on.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And these tourist gaze, right, these imaginaries also make places, right? So the other two chapters of part one addresses the issues of placemaking, which also really reflect these kinds of associated imaginaries. And Dr. Shenik, in your chapter, right, you talk about how frequent tourism actually influenced how Buddhism is presented and also practiced in Chiang Mai temples in Thailand. So my question is, what kind of relationship do the Chiang Mai Buddhas have with the tourist? And you also point out really interestingly that there seems to be some divergent views between monks and lay Thai Buddhists with regard to tourism. Can you tell us more about this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll take on this question about my own chapter, and then we'll hear from Courtney soon. So yeah, for me, I'm trying to develop and understand the space of the temple and how that relates to tourists in this chapter. And I do juxtapose the lay view with the monastic view in Chiang Mai, where I conducted my fieldwork. But for me, it's always been difficult to get like a representative, qualitative understanding of lay Buddhist views, especially on tourism, because they don't stay in the temple often very long. You know, they might go in, do their thing with merit making and then leave. They might not even notice if tourists are there. They're not really like paying attention to it unless, you know, they might notice if there's a foreign monk or if there's like a tourist that's acting like really, you know, appropriately and like respectfully, or there's a tourist acting really inappropriately. So I had to rely on kind of some media moments when Thai Buddhists were shocked and outraged, as the commentary goes in the Thai and English media about this. When Thai Buddhists look at the tourists' actions and they kind of decide that they're inappropriate and that they kind of take away from the sacredness of the place. And it also kind of takes away from the lay Buddhists, you know, understanding of the place and as a sacred place, and also their kind of ownership over the nature of the place. So, I mean, in none of the cases, in none of the chapters have we seen anything like tourists, you know, just taking over and like nobody cares, you know, like there's places that need to be, you know, there needs to be some kind of Buddhism maintained here, even in places that have like a lot of tourists. And so that's a kind of like the kind of worry, I think, of some of the Thai Buddhists, that, you know, the tourists might just not know the ways to behave. And that could lead to a kind of desacralization of the place. And so Thai Buddhists have a idea called Galatesa, and it means that you kind of align your behavior and your appearance to the place. And so you show your respect and your understanding of the respect for of that place that should be respected through your actions. And so I look at moments like tourists doing yoga in, you know, inappropriate outfits, touching each other with like the stupas in the background as a kind of nice photo, or a person wearing beach attire to the temple. And so Thai Buddhists, you know, kind of get upset about this because of the reasons I stated before. But for monks, it's a lot different because they live in the temples and they can see a different side to the tourists. They're not just looking at the kind of bad moments or, you know, only the good moments. They can kind of see the medium where there's tourists who are respectful of the place and they're basically curious and interested in what's going on and want to know more. And so I look at the different kinds of cultural exchange programs that student monks in particular have set up so that they can answer tourist questions, be in dialogue with them, teach them a little bit about Buddhism and the monastic life. And so they think of it as a way to tourism is a way to let Buddhism spread, rather than being as concerned with defacing the sacredness of the temple.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a really fascinating chapter to read. And the other chapter in part one, written by Justin Reisinger, we are presented with a really interesting kind of situation of contestation over Buddhist placemaking, right? So the competition between Mount Xuedo and Mount Fanjing to become the next true home for Maitreya, the future Buddha, and thus the fifth sacred mountain in China. So here, Reisinger argues that Buddhist placemaking rests not only on the public imaginary of what Buddhist places should be, or its sort of spiritual efficacy, but also on more pragmatic considerations. So tell us more about the processes of marketing Maitreya, the term used in this chapter. What factors go into the creation of a sacred place in contemporary China, for example?
Yeah, so Justin's chapter is really lovely. It points to the idea that historically sites were sacred and they were famous because they had link. They had this numinous power. Perhaps pilgrims had an image of the resident bodhisattva that was there, and this sparked pilgrimage. But what we have in contemporary China is an interesting coming together of various forms of capital. And this is what his chapter does so nicely, is by comparing these two sites and really seeing how they are both claiming their location to be the authentic home of Maitreya, we begin to see how important social, economic, and cultural capital play. into this. And so sometimes that's historical, right? Sometimes sites are going to get cultural capital from the historical connections between Maitreya and the location. But it, what's also really important that he points out is the social capital. And a lot of this will come from the social networks that are part of that mountain, the role of spectacle. So he talks quite a bit about the colossal images of the Buddha that are created there, of Maitreya Buddha that are created there. So Shui Do's grand Buddha holds advantage for that site because it's a spectacle and it's a symbol that very much represents Maitreya, that represents a recognizable form. And if you have an unrecognizable form, then that is actually potentially going to hurt the social capital that you gain. And so really what we see with his chapter is that sites in contemporary China are competing with each other, that they're we have a large set of Chinese citizens who are mobile, who are able to be tourists, and it's really up to the site to draw them in. And history isn't always enough to be the reason why they come. So Shui Do does have advantages that come from history, but really what he argues is that Shui Do has advantages because there has been a skill set with the residents there that have been woven into the site, into these currents of contemporary Chinese culture. And Maitreya as a symbol, as being represented in this colossal image, has really helped associate the mountain with the idea that this is truly Maitreya's form and location. Fang Jing does as well. You know, the official claim is that the mountain is the sanctuary of Maitreya's true form. But by comparing the two, what we begin to see is that it's really important that there is a connection with local government officials. There is a connection between a site and other forms of tourism, such as things like ecotourism. And really what he argues is that at Mount Fangjing, the cultural products are less effectively marketed. And so really what's seen in this chapter is the understanding that for a site to be successful in China today as a location for Buddhist tourism, it's not just the numinous power that's present, but it really is coming down to the disparity in cultural and economic capital that's going to be compounded with differences in social capital.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. And speaking of secular entities and secular powers, right, this is sort of the focus in part two of the book entitled Secularizing the Sacred. So here it reveals, interestingly, that Buddhist tourism actually tend to create alliances with secular forces as strategies to promote their traditions and sacred sites. So here, John Marston's chapter on Cambodian pilgrimage groups in India and Sri Lanka covers this alliance between the Cambodian pilgrims and their tourist companies. And then Matthew Tru's chapter shows this alliance between Angkor Wat and its surrounding non-Buddhist spaces. So what's really interesting in these two chapters is sort of the overlapping imaginaries of Buddhist space imagined by the international Buddhist tourists, the Buddhist sites themselves, and also participating in secular entities. So I guess my question is, what are the drives behind these overlapping imaginaries and efforts at placemaking?
Okay, thank you for this question. I like how you've combined these two chapters, which both discuss Cambodian Buddhism in different ways. In John Marston's chapter, he's talking about Cambodian pilgrims on pilgrimage to important Buddhist sites in Sri Lanka and Cambodia, and the different kinds of imaginaries and placemakings that they have to kind of negotiate on their travels. And so they have to engage with the merit economy, because that's like the main point of their trip, is to be merit making. But at the same time, there's these kinds of secular incursions from, you know, the fact that they're traveling, they're part of an economic marketplace, you know, while they're abroad, and, you know, just in their daily lives as lay people as well. And then they're also, while they're traveling, negotiating their own ideas about Buddhism from their own history as Cambodian Buddhists with particular kinds of practices, and that how this kind of is different from some of the practices that they see of Theravada Buddhism in India when they encounter that. And so this negotiation isn't always easy, especially when, as Marston notes, that there's like always kind of a concern and a defensiveness, if anything, related to terms like tourism, or like the kind of tourism companies and the business aspect of it, or the package deals that this pilgrim groups would have booked, because they want things to stay much more focused on things that would be more acceptable to them, like, you know, part of their pilgrimage would be, you know, it's merit making. That's what it's really about. It's about the merit economy, about the donations that they're making there. And so the effort to making this pilgrimage was to really maintain the idea of sacredness, but then any kind of connection to tourism was deemed as kind of more secular and therefore lesser. So we do see that there is some kind of binary going on here, you know, that still kind of exists, although, you know, it's very hard to negotiate in, you know, in reality. And then Matthew True's chapter is looking at Battambang in Cambodia. And here they're kind of building on the imaginaries of Angkor Wat and the idea of the kind of ruins that are the main tourist draw in Cambodia. But in Battambang, they don't really have this kind of ruin. So they're kind of banking on the tourists' temple fatigue, which I didn't know was a real thing, but he references it as a real thing among tourists. And I just thought it was something that I experienced even myself when I was in Asia. But in Battambang, what they have done is rely on thematic tourism, which kind of interacts with the imaginaries of Buddhism and Angkor Wat and like the idea of Cambodia for the tourists. So they're drawing on the ideas of Buddhism and national history. So True identifies three themes of these different sites that he looks at. There's like the one about Buddhism that's more for international tourists, and there's one about and Cambodian folklore for domestic tourists, and then there's a site that has to do with the genocide of Cambodia, and then there's one that's more like for everyone, the wonder of nature. And so like my chapter, he finds that there's this contestation over tourism in some of his ethnographic work there, that some of the managers of the sites are welcoming for the tourists, welcoming the money that they provide to improve temples, and others would prefer it to maintain its quiet, sacred nature. So for both of the chapters, the various imaginaries of Cambodian Buddhists in India and in Cambodia, and there's different imaginaries for international tourists who visit Cambodia as well. And we can understand through these the different ways that managers and promoters of tourist sites and pilgrim groups learn how to adjust to the different imaginaries of the different groups. That we can see in like the wonder of nature for the temple fatigued international tourists, and then the kind of exclusive framing of sacredness and merit making for the Cambodian pilgrims. So I think we can see like which parts of Buddhism then are the most fundamental and which can be kind of adjusted for which individuals and how they make those arguments. And we can see which practices and ideas like are critiqued or accepted and when those take place.
Yeah, it's really interesting that it kind of, it's a very organic industry, right? Of Buddhist tourism involving all kinds of agents and participants. It's fascinating. And the other two chapters of this part two of the book addresses similar case studies in China and Japan, right? So Dr. Brunt's, your chapter here, along with Ian Reeder's chapter, discusses how Buddhists in contemporary China and Japan, respectively, are utilizing secular means to enhance and also revitalize tourism, however, coming from very different concerns. So what's the relationship between Buddhists and the secular forces in these two countries addressed in your chapters? Why are they similarly finding secular means such as commercial tourism and technology really useful for religious expansions?
Yeah, thank you. So it's an interesting comparison because, you know, Reeder's work, he throughout, you know, many years has always really encouraged us to understand Buddhists engaging in commercial operations as part of skillful means, as part of survival, especially in Japan. And so when we think of that word survival, it's really helpful for seeing a crossover between the case of China and the case of Japan. So with the case of Japan, you know, his work has spoken largely to really getting people engaged in spirituality and really religiosity, and that Buddhists have had to turn to commercial operators in order to continue to attract visitors. And this is also then taken up later in Matthew Mitchell's chapter as well, is that in order to continue to really attract visitors, that they've needed to engage in these partnerships, that it's very strategic. And so his work really turns to looking at what are the commercial agencies that Buddhists have turned to, even coming down to, he speaks about posters and advertisements. He talks about national rail companies that they create very skillful partnerships with in order to ensure that the temples are on the mind states of Japanese citizens. And from my work, I see that really similarly in China as well, especially when we think about Buddhist sites are engaged in a commercial operation. They are engaged in a capitalist society where they are competing with other heritage sites. And this is something that a lot of the authors throughout our entire volume will talk about is the more that they are selling their site as cultural and a site of heritage, that they are able to attract visitors and that helps them to survive. We see that strongly in the case of China as well. So in the case of China, what we have is government operations will create Buddhist heritage sites. They'll create Buddhist cultural sites. And these are locations that Buddhist temples have to compete with and mountains have to compete with. And so what I'm seeing is that, and similar to the case of Japan, is that it is really skillful means for Buddhists to engage with secular forces, for them to make use of technologies that are available to them, make use of platforms for marketing that are available to them. So similar to what Ian Reeder writes about in regards to Japan, of thinking about agencies that are going to spread marketing through poster ads, my work looks at how Buddhist monks are making use of internet platforms, making use of WeChat, these sorts of avenues and platforms to turn their messages digital, to propagate the Dharma in that way, and to create opportunities for young people to engage in discourse with monastics that perhaps they wouldn't otherwise. So when I was interviewing monks in China, I kind of asked them about this. I asked, you know, what do they think about this? And they saw this as being part of the 21st century, as that this is their new text, I suppose, is going online is their new text. And so what we see in both of the chapters is that it's really for survival for various reasons. Of course, in Japan, we have population concerns. We have concerns about maintaining tradition of enticing young people to want to be religious. But we have those same concerns in China as well of really encouraging young people to go to temples, to be interested in Buddhism. And so what monks are doing is they are using platforms that they figure young people are already on, like WeChat, and using that as an avenue, as skillful means to continue to attract young people to be interested in Buddhism.
Yeah, thank you. These are really fascinating chapters, both of them. And they also, in a way, engage with, commodification of Buddhism, or presenting it through commodities such as WeChat. And this is sort of the center of attention in part three, which shifts our discussion to commodification and its consequences. So Brian Nichols' chapter takes a really interesting emic approach and shows that commodification is actually not necessarily at odds with Buddhism, nor is it a very new phenomenon. And Elizabeth William Warburg's chapter on the commodification of Buddhism as a unique selling proposition, USP, in Ladakh, she shows this and confirms this. And Matthew Mitchell's chapter further gives us a unique case study where romantic love, right, becomes the product that is being intentionally commodified on Buddhist sites. So I guess the question that our readers and listeners might be curious about is, so how compatible is Buddhism with commodification and commercialization? And how are these commercially motivated behaviors reconciled in a way with religiosity or doctrines? Has there been any voices of opposition?
Brian's chapter is really such a wonderful addition to this volume, because what he does very well is he sets up this great argument that is really useful to all of us, an argument looking at strong and weak commoditization. You know, so scholars across Asia have really grappled with this idea of what does it mean for Buddhists to commodify their sites? Does that fit with the teachings of Buddhism? How do we feel about that? What does that say? What does that tell us? And how do we make sense of that? And as I said earlier, my chapter and Ian's chapter really make sense of that in terms of skillful means, that this is survival. This is a way to continue to attract people to come and venture to sites that perhaps they wouldn't otherwise, and especially in the midst of competition. And Brian comes down on the same idea. He talks a lot about the disruptive nature of tourism, which is helpful. You know, tourists are loud. They're noisy. They disrupt activities of meditation that are happening at monasteries. They are sometimes really messy. what has been encouraging sites to charge exorbitant fees to get in has been this competition. And so there are these disruptions from tourism that very much cause practitioners to question the authenticity of a site, its relevance, and really whether or not they should venture there for spiritual development. And so what Brian does very nicely is he points us to thinking about commoditization as strong and weak. So strong commoditization would be in the form of charging a fee to enter into a temple. But weak commoditization is really when we're thinking about temples that perhaps have a vegetarian restaurant, maybe they have a tea shop. Those are just activities that are supporting the institution. And what's helpful is that when we begin to think about it in that way, it further cuts through this binary of the sacred secular discourse, right? It really helps us to think about sites in a different way, as some sites having strong commoditization, some sites having weak commoditization. And he does see this as skillful means, as upaya. He comes down, and his central argument really comes down that this is that while tourism does disrupt, it is not at odds with larger Buddhist goals.
he really understands the goal of Buddhism to spread the Dharma. And so tourism is not going to be at odds with that. But what helps us to kind of identify and think about temples in a different way is his argument regarding strong and weak commoditization. What we see with Mitchell's chapter is, again, this notion of survival. And his chapter is such a fun addition, right? Because his chapter is having to do with people finding love at temples. And it's a great chapter for teaching, just to plug it there, because students absolutely love hearing about people finding love at Buddhist temples. And what he's looking at is really how temples have remarketed themselves in Japan and have done so in a way that isn't, it's not necessarily associated with religion, that people's interest in Buddhism is something that they share in common, but really they're trying to find love. And so what his chapter focuses on and really is a great insight for us is to think about the pressures that young people are under, the societal pressures to get married, and that Buddhism begins to fill that role. Buddhist sites and priests can really promote their location as being a place to find a mate. And so he looks at these various programs, which helps us to think about the emergence of temple stay programs, connecting back to other chapters in the book. And so it's a different way that Buddhist temples are marketing themselves. And again, we see this theme of young people. And so he agrees with his work then agrees very nicely with Nichols that this isn't going against the larger goal of Buddhism, because the larger goal of Buddhism, I suppose we could say across all these chapters, is to spread the Dharma, to propagate the Dharma. And it's another form of really encouraging people to come and learn. And that's what we also saw with the previous chapters as well, with Reader's chapter and my chapter as well, is that a lot of Buddhists are seeing tourism as the mechanism to entice people to visit the site. But then after visiting the site, maybe they'll learn more about Buddhism. And with our last chapter of regarding Ladakh, we really see the strong sense of Buddhism as a unique selling point. And Elizabeth's chapter is really exciting. And Brooke, I wonder if you would want to tackle that a little bit, because you have visited Ladakh.
I have visited Ladakh with Elizabeth, our author herself. Elizabeth Williams Orberg in this chapter, it's fitting to have it as the last chapter, because it kind of dovetails with the other South Asian chapter of David Geary's in the first chapter, because he's talking about this kind of, you know, imaginary peace, but in Ladakh, which is in contrast to kind of it's a selling point as a living kind of Buddhism. It's like Little Tibet in India. Like, you can visit Tibetan Buddhism in an Indian context. And so it's a kind of a different kind of India where you can experience Buddhism as it's lived. But again, it's also just a kind of vague idea of, you know, Buddhism. It's because, you know, it's part of India, which normally you wouldn't associate all of India with Buddhism. But Elizabeth does describe how this kind of idea of just Buddhism itself kind of is in the air in Ladakh, and how it gets promoted as everything kind of like touches onto Buddhism. And it helps to increase the tourism there. And she finds that the consumerism and commodification don't really dilute or lose any kind of the sacredness of Buddhist influence in Ladakh. Rather, everyone is very interested in enhancing this even more through the government's promotion of this, through their investment in tourism, so that both can relate to each other, where Buddhists are benefiting from the tourism, from the government promotion, from the infrastructure improvement, from the tourist money, as well as tourism. The people are benefiting from Buddhism. She does go to, in one part, I think, of this chapter, she goes and talks to some of the Muslim hotel owners, and even they are interested in connecting the imaginary of their space in Ladakh with Buddhism, because, you know, everyone there kind of understands, like, this is what we have. This is our brand, and the branding is kind of working. And so we can see that the, you know, of course there's some kind of ripples underneath, you know, we're just talking in general here, that the idea of Buddhism and this idea of this living Buddhism in Ladakh is, people are really, going for it. And this idea of the USP that, Elizabeth described so well.
Thank you. I think we've covered most of the chapters, actually all of the chapters, really well already. And I have one more question that's sort of, I was wondering, like, what are the effects of COVID-19 on Buddhist tourism recently, if we know enough to say something about this?
I've been following this, you know, trying to follow this a little bit. There's a lot of discussion in tourism studies about this and the major effects that it's having. I know in Southeast Asia, it's been a rise in promotion of domestic tourism, especially in Thailand, because that's what they have to work with. But of course, like, so much of the tourism industry has been lost. Monks that I know have been, you know, they're used to talking to tourists and have them as a lot of their programs and dialogue partners. They have transitioned to online, so they're offering a lot of online programs instead, and offering a lot of Facebook live streaming, like answering questions like they would normally do in the temple. And, you know, they have some participants, maybe some people have already been there and have made connections with them. It might be hard to make newer connections and to spread Buddhism that way, but they still are very interested in spreading Buddhism and do believe that their teachings and the teachings of the Buddha are extremely relevant for this time, and would like to help people to get through the pandemic with, you know, teachings like equanimity and acceptance and, you know, accepting reality, accepting uncertainty, things like that. And advice that they're giving has been helpful to many people, I think, so far. But I really hope that for the sake of a lot of people's livelihoods, that tourism can come back in Asia, because a lot of Southeast Asia, it does rely on that.
Yeah, definitely. And Dr. Bruntz, would you like to add something? How is it affecting Buddhist tourism in China, for example?
Yeah, so we have seen, you know, quite a drop in the revenue, right? And so a lot of the research that has been coming out regarding China has been similar to what Brooke was talking about regarding tourism studies. So a lot of the work that I've been following has been just looking at how much hotel revenue, those sorts of things have dropped. Temples obviously had to close in the spring. But the difference in, you know, in China, China has coped with COVID-19 pretty rapidly. You know, what we see in places like Taiwan is, I believe the statistics as of yesterday, Taiwan didn't have a community-wide new case in 200 days, I believe was the statistic that came out yesterday. Yeah, so, you know, in Taiwan, that's really good for Buddhist tourism there. China as well has been able to just temporarily closed down. And then my friends, you know, this week, not this week, but earlier in October, people were traveling and going to sites like the Forbidden City once again. And so we do definitely see people getting out and about.
I mean, Courtney, I think it's like the difference between international and domestic, you know, populations. So if you're mostly domestic and your country is all right, then, you know, Buddhism can kind of proceed just without, you know, some temples might have an international component that might be missing, but it's probably not crucial. But some of the places that I've worked with are used to having a lot of international interaction. And so that's probably why they've thought to do some of the online work. But mostly in Thailand too, it's been, you know, really well contained. So I think that the temples themselves are fine. They're kind of just lacking that extra revenue that they would have gotten from international tourists.
Can I add something? So because my work has focused on Buddhist monks making use of technology, the one thing that actually is really beneficial for thinking about is that when you do make use of technology, your propagation of the Dharma isn't contingent upon being together physically. And so they can still spread. So similar to what Brooke was talking about of spreading ideas for how to cope with this time, what I also will find on, you know, the subscriptions that I am part of on the, you know, from temples in China that I subscribe to on WeChat, you know, they might have a topic that has to do with how kindness keeps loneliness at bay, these sorts of things, right? And so I think in many ways, what we might see, or, you know, how to put down distracting thoughts. So what we might see is that Buddhists are trying to maintain interest so that when things do can fully open up again, that people then are still interested in going to Buddhist sites, and then those swarms of tourists will return.
Thank you so much for your answers for this question. I know it's still very recent and new development, still in development. So we'll have to see what are the kind of long lasting impacts that the pandemic will have on Buddhists everywhere. And finally, we have one final question for our recording for our interview that's traditional to the New Books Network is, can you tell us about what are some of the projects you're working on right now? Yeah, maybe we'll start with Dr. Shetnek. Would you like to start?
Okay, thank you. Yes, I'm getting ready to publish a monograph kind of related to this edited volume, and the monograph is called Religious Tourism in Northern Thailand, Encounters with Buddhist Monks through the University of Washington Press. And so it'll be out sometime next year. And so I hope to come back on the New Buddhist New Books Network for that. And so it's focused on Chiang Mai, Thailand, Northern Thailand. And it focuses on the recent conjunctures of education, urbanization, and tourism in the city, and how this has affected had a number of results, like affecting temple economics, attitudes towards religious others, missionization, and individual possibilities for transforming the self. So that's what is coming out soon. Right now, I don't really have anything I'm working on related to tourism necessarily, but I've become interested in the kind of perceptions of the Thai monastic body, like the actual body and performance of monasticism in an embodied way in Thailand. So I'm looking at a lot of media and regulations and perceptions about how the Thai monastic body should be, what is appropriate, what should be allowed, what should not be allowed. And so some of this is kind of related a little bit to my discussion of tourism, and that I'm looking at media and I'm looking at the, you know, what Thai lay people think is appropriate and inappropriate, but then in this case, applying it to the body of monks. And I'm also writing like a kind of introductory book to lived contemporary Theravada Buddhism for Shambhala Press, and that's a little bit more for a general audience, and that's really fun to write.
Thank you. Yeah, I saw that a call for papers for your Buddhism and body special issues for religions. Sounds like a really interesting, very exciting collection of papers. And thank you so much. These are really exciting. And Dr. Bruns?
So I unfortunately have been delayed in some of my research because of COVID. So I had a grant to go to Japan this summer to look at the AI Canon, the Android Canon.
Cool.
And so I was going to continue this idea of digitization and use of technology, and then you really go into the realm of looking at AI. So that's been put on hold. And in the meantime, you know, probably many of us have done, I don't know, is, you know, when you can't go, when you can't leave and you're kind of in your own backyard, you begin to think, well, how can I transfer some of my research, some of my training into my community? And so actually, you know, what I've been working on right now is less academic and much more about community development and work with the community and community engagement, which may end up being published in some form of. And so this is kind of thinking about pedagogy, not just in the traditional 4-year college classroom, but then also engaging older folks into community partnerships and development with marginalized groups within the community. So I've been doing a lot more kind of a shift, like activism in that sense, I suppose, in my local community. And then we'll kind of return back to scholarly work in the future. But that's really kind of where my efforts have been the past 6 months during COVID.
That's so cool, Courtney.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Yeah, it's very important to reach out to our community, especially in these times.
Yeah, I think a lot of what I found is that the loneliness too factor, you know, if there's ways that we can kind of think about like using Buddhist teachings. I don't know. These are all the things that I think a lot of us are probably thinking about, right? Of what does it mean not just to write about Buddhism, but maybe be inspired, I guess. I don't know.
Definitely, definitely. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm sure I am definitely looking forward to your future works. Hopefully, when they're published, you can speak to us again on the New Books Network. But thank you so much. I think we've taken up a lot of your time already. Again, thank you so much for being on the show amidst these really strange times.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Thank you, Dana.
All right, until next time.